Okay, so maybe the first thing to say is what a special occasion this screening is for us as well, because I think for both of us this is actually the first time we've had the occasion to see this film on the big screen, and that tells you something about the singularity of this film, the way that it was made as a one-off, and the way that once it was made, like a flash in a moment of darkness, it then disappeared and existed for people of our generation. So the generation that was born from the 1970s to the 1980s, the generation that grew up with a sense that something revolutionary happened in Thailand in 1973, and then something else happened which couldn't be spoken about, growing up in a condition of silence about what this terrible something else that happened was that couldn't be spoken about. And within that, we grew up with a sense that there was this film called Tong Pan, this sort of fascinating ghost of a film, which we know exists but couldn't be seen. So it was a long, long time before Tong Pan began to resurface. It wasn't until the late 1990s, and it wasn't until the early 2000s when it was possible for the political massacre of 1976 in Thailand to be spoken about, and the stories and also the artistic artifacts from that particular moment to begin to be made public again. So the first time that I saw Tong Pan was not until the early 2000s in a very poor cinema form, on a format called, which was popular in Southeast Asia at that time, called a video CD and MP2 kind of format. So it's, you know, it's taken decades for us to get to this moment when we're actually now able to see print of this quality in the cinema. So this is a pretty special moment for us as well.
Yeah. The first time I saw Tong Pan, I think it's like 3 years ago. Yeah. Even I am a film student in Thailand. Yeah. I didn't see Tong Pan. Yeah. And maybe I start with the production and exhibition history of Tong Pan. Yeah. As you see, the film was framed by two very important political events in Thailand, which is there is a student uprising in 14 October 1923, and after that the film, as you see, the film is a reenactment of the real event, and that event happened in the 1975, the seminar about the dam, the construction of the dam. At that time, a group of activists look into the area, and they want to search for the villagers whose life was affected by the construction of the dam. And then at that place they found Tong Pan whose life was as you see affected by the construction of the dam. And the group of activists invite Tong Pan to the seminar, but it turns out that the seminar wasn't useful for him at all. And when he went back to his home, his wife passed away. Yeah, and then he and his children disappear. Yeah, and this group of activists, they were so moved by the story of Tong Pan, so they decide to reenact the whole story and then film it. So, so after the seminar, 1 year after the seminar, they start to shooting Tong Pan, and the shoot went for 2 months. But the film wasn't processed yet. There was a massacre happened before the cutting of the film, and some of the filmmakers decide to fled away and went to the forest to hide and to join the communist party who live in the forest. And another participants of the film, yeah, need to escape from Thailand and they take the film, yeah, to Hong Kong, yeah, to process in Hong Kong, and then they need to the post production process was continue here in London and in Sweden, and then maybe I'm not sure if it's 1977 or 1978. Yeah, the film was premiered in London Film Festival. So today is like the 40-year anniversary of Thong Phan, the journey of Thong Phan back to London. Yeah, 40 years. Yeah, and at the same time, the film was premiered in Thailand at the Golden Inn Institute. Yeah, and after that. Yeah, the film went to screen in London, Edinburgh, Hong Kong, Melbourne, and the film was celebrated, particularly among the Southeast Asian scholars or the political scientists. Yeah, but what is interesting for Thong Phan is that Thong Phan wasn't studied in terms of its aesthetics, at all. And today is so interesting because Thong Phan was selected into SA Film Festival. Yeah, so this is more or less the first time that we should see Thong Phan from the point of view of the aesthetic. Yeah. This is the October 6, 1976. This picture, this is the real seminar. Yeah, mm-hmm. Happens in 1975. Yeah, right. But this photograph is so important because after the student massacre, the right wing newspaper used that photograph, and reframe the photograph. This is the headline. Yeah, the headline said that this photograph is the proof that the people in the photograph were the communists. Yeah, so it's this is the right wing newspaper plan to attack the people in the photograph. Yeah.
Maybe we could go back to the photograph. So this is a photograph of the seminar that then became the starting point for the film. And you can see in the photograph some of the people who were actually involved in the film. Some of them, do I recognize Zulaksi Walaki acted in the film. So
yeah.
You saw him in the seminar, you saw him in the seminar. And the starting point of the film was that one of the people in the group that then called themselves the Isan Film Collective, Pai Chong Lai Sukun, at this point was working as a research assistant stroke NGO, and she was tasked with actually going out to the remote areas of the northeast of Thailand to bring people to come and join in this seminar. So it was Pai Chong Lai Sukun, the woman who then acted as a producer, one of the producers for the film. It was her experience of going out and finding the people and bringing them to the seminar and then encountering the complete limitation of that idea of an exercise of democratic voice, which was the seed of the idea for the film. So this is a photo of the real seminar, which then about a year or two later, so at this point, after 1973, where a democratic uprising, demonstrations involving 500,000 people in the streets of Bangkok brought down a military dictatorship, which then led to a rare moment of political and cultural renaissance in the country. That was a moment when a socialist politician campaigning as a socialist politician actually managed to be elected as an MP. this moment, towards the end of the Cold War, where the Cold War was at its hottest in Southeast Asia, then led very quickly to a violent backlash, resulting in a massacre of communists and student protesters, again right in the heart of Bangkok, a very barbaric and brutal lynching. So in the period running up, the couple of years running up to 1976, where you had sort of democratic revolution and the whole sort of period of cultural openness that came with it, and also immediately a kind of anti-communist backlash surfacing very strongly with a very extreme use of the media, images and representations in order to create this climate, anti-communist climate. You then got an extreme right-wing newspaper taking this photo and claiming that this is evidence of a meeting hosted by the KGB in order to plan a communist plot to take over Thailand. So that was why then the next image. This is what's being claimed in this newspaper headline, published about a year after that seminar about the impact of the dam. And the headline set here says, "Reveal Reds, sponsored by the Soviet to bring down the country." So that kind of gives you an idea of the context in which then the people involved in the making of Tong Pan after 1976 had to leave, had to disappear.
To say that who was the director of Tong Pan may not justify the idea of who really made Tong Pan, because Tong Pan was should be perceived more as a collective, and actually the fact that the end credit of Tong Pan didn't have the full credit. Mm-hmm. Manifest the political climate and the end credit is the statement itself that this film was made by the Isan Film Collective. This is the key persons in the collective, which include Michael Morrow, who was a journalist and he funded the film. And then Kam Sing Sinok, he is a farmer turned novelist, right? Who are screenwriter, the film. And then there is a Pai Chong Lai Sekun, who is a researcher, and as May said, she is the one who found Tong Pan, actually she is the one who run the whole process, from start to the film finish, And then there was Sulachai Chantimathon, who is like a Thailand's version of Bob Dylan, and he was the director, especially for the outdoor scene, And then there is Yutana Mukdasinik, he is the director for the indoor scene, And then, there is Frank Green, who is a UCLA graduate, and he is a cinematographer. But as we see that the film, the cinematograph in the film is so powerful and in a way we may think of Frank Green as one of the director of the film, and then there is Joe Gordon, and there is the person who played Tong Pan, he is a real boxer, so that's why he that is a boxing scene. Okay.
So, watching it this time around, I mean, the sense that it's a film of composite authorship, and I think at certain moments you almost feel like this is a couple of films or a couple of possible films branching out from this one composite work. So, marks of authorship. That I recognize in terms of the sense of irony of the story itself, of having a seminar in which you invite the peasant to participate, and that moment of supreme irony where the two peasant men says, well, this is actually the things that we need, the things that are our concern, which the moment in which the logic of a sort of elite exercise in democracy falls apart. That sense of irony I recognize very strongly from the short stories of Kam Sing Si Nok. Kam Sing Si Nok is a one of the socialist short story writers, a very important and pioneering figure in the Thai modern novel form, who came to prominence during what's called the American era in Thailand, so the mid to the height of the Cold War to the end of the Cold War, writing short stories and novels which were sort of supremely modernist, ironic exercises in caricaturing and satirizing the US-sponsored developmental logic of the Cold War, which was very much an engine of ideological inculcation, an engine of turning Thailand into a client state of the US. So that the sort of overall narrative structure of the film, I think you can see a lot of influence from Kam Sing Si Nok there. And as Guy Wood was saying, in terms of the visual authorship of the film, very fascinating, and I think this is really two films in one. The seminar scene, the interior scenes, shot by Yutthanam Mukdasanit, who is in Thai film history an important figure for... he was one of the pioneers of the first new wave film in Thailand, emerging from the late 1970s, very influenced by New Hollywood. He was responsible for shooting the seminar scene. What we were talking about, and I think the really intriguing thing about this film is who was aesthetically responsible for the scenes shot outside of Bangkok, scenes of incredible poetry, observational poetry, looking at small town life, the close-ups of the faces, the animals, the streets, the physical beauty of Tong Pan, and also the sense of anger that he holds within him. Whose authorship was that? And one thing to start looking into, nobody has done this, but I think it's sort of one of the people to try to track down and have a chat with, we think possibly could be this chap called Frank Green, who in one of the few substantial Thai language interviews that we could find with Pai Tong Lai Skun, the film's producer, where she talks at length about who did what in the film, she mentions Frank Green as coming on board because he had just graduated from UCLA at that point, so the film started being made in 1976-7. So had just graduated from UCLA, had started living in Thailand, and happened to have 16mm camera. So he came, and he was friends with Mike Morrow and Pai Tong, who at that point they were partners. So he came on board as the cinematographer and shot the scenes outside of Bangkok in a province in the lower part of the northeast of Thailand. And I think this is, she didn't say what he studied at UCLA, so I'm purely speculating, but I think this is worth chasing up. If he was studying filmmaking at UCLA sometime in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, who would have been his contemporaries? One filmmaker I can think of is Charles Burnett, American independent filmmaker who made Killer of Sheep, who was very influenced. He was taught by a British poetic documentary filmmaker called Basil Wright. And I think I can see shades of the sort of documentary poetic sensibility coming through in the outdoor scenes of Tong Pan, which perhaps, pure speculation, has some link with the sort of independent stroke experimental filmmaking sensibility that was in the ether in UCLA at that point. So this is one of the things that we think one of us needs to chase up quite soon. So if anyone knows anything about this chap called Frank Green, we looked him up on IMDb. He's done a couple of documentaries since. Really curious about Frank Green. And Sunatai Jantimathong, you see in the film's moment of supreme utopia, the music scene, the guy with the bird on his shoulder. And this is such a special moment because there are very few other Thai films that I can think of that attains this moment of utopian poetry, maybe after that, you know, Apitapong's Scenes from Syndromes in a Century from Apitapong Weerasethakun's film. But that sort of a sensibility of utopian transcendence is something very, very unusual, given the sort of aesthetics of Thai film.
And apart from directing, Surachai Chanthemathorn also, of course, composed the songs, yeah. And the songs at that time was banned, yeah. Surachai Chanthemathorn, yeah, was perceived as a Bob Dylan type in Thailand. And he actually took the melody from Bob Dylan's song, yeah, in the song called Man and Buffalo, which is the opening song of the film, yeah. And since the song was banned, the group of filmmakers, Pai Zong, yeah, she said that since the song was banned, of course the film will be banned too, yeah. So yeah, she didn't intend to submit the film to the board of the board in Thailand. What else? This is Frank Green, yeah. And this is Michael Morrow, yeah. Yeah, and this is that scene, yeah, that scene that Surachai sings. Yeah. And then the lead actor of the film, yeah. His name is Ong Ak Phon Thong, but he later changed his name to Thong Pan, yeah. Yeah. And then after that film, yeah, he was cast as a lead actor in a very famous film in Thailand called Luk Isan or Son of the Northeast, yeah. And this film, we can trace this film to Apichatpong, yeah, because Apichatpong loves Vichit Kunawut so much, yeah. And if you see Apichatpong film, you see that his film is associated so much with the northeastern, yeah, area in Thailand. And this is Pai Zong Lai Sakun, yeah. And this picture was taken last year, yeah. Pai Zong, in this picture, she stands with Anocha, yeah, who is a director of a new wave film, new wave Thai film called By the Time It Gets Dark, which may release soon in London, yeah, within this year, yeah. And what is interesting is that in this film, By the Time It Gets Dark, which is a new film, the film stars Rasmi Pao Leung Thong, who is one of the directors of Thong Pan, and the story of the By the Time It Gets Dark, the story starts at the massacre in 1976, so there is some connection.
I was going to open it to the audience.
Yeah.
I first want to thank you for your excellent presentation, for opening up the film to the audiences who aren't as aware of the context as well. I mean, it's been a brief question. I was wondering the pictures of the production. Like where are they sourced from? Are you like in contact with the makers, or are they just readily available?
They came from an interview with Pai Zong, which was first published in a journal called Thai Film Journal, which is no longer operational, but for about a decade, from the from the late 1990s, a group called the not the Thai Film Archive, the other one, Thai Film Foundation, in the moment where they had the energy and they weren't too busy to do it. They produced for about 10 years a journal in the Thai language, very much pushing for the need to do historical research into Thai cinema, and also creating a space where there could be writing on non-mainstream forms of cinema. So one of the really great things that they did was an extensive interview with Pai Chong, and the photos we took from there. Or were you asking about the photos of the police, the military massacre, or the production itself? Yeah. So they're available. It's just a question if somebody needs to go into archives or go talk to this person and that person and collate personal collections, newspapers, and so on.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I'm curious. Perhaps you have said that and I didn't quite capture this information. But has this collective produced other films?
No,
actually,
no. This was. The collective itself, this was a one-time.
So one-off, absolutely.
One-off collective. But I think it's interesting to contextualize their calling themselves a collective and the moment of making this film, and you would know about this, within a broader moment of art making in Thailand in the 1970s. That was you know, one of the few moments in which people got together and called themselves collectives, right?
Yeah.
So I think you could see this as being of a piece with the sort of art collectives that were being articulated and named in the country at that point, very much as a consequence of the cultural renaissance that came with this revolution of 73.
How much experience did they have of filmmaking?
None.
None.
None. Yeah. So in this long
it's
interview...
It's hard to believe,
actually. Yeah.
Surachai, she invited Surachai, the musician, the guy with the bird on his shoulder, said, "Can you come and direct?" He said, "I've never directed." She said, "Never mind, come." But, you know, that sort of energy, where did it come from? I think it came from that particular political moment. Let's do it, we can do it, let's do it.
And what about Pai Chong? Did she work on other...
No, she had just graduated and she was working as a research assistant.
So she never did any other... film.
No. The only person with some experience would have been Yutana Mukherjee.
Yutana, yeah, because he worked as an assistant director, yeah. And in an interview, Pai Chong said that Yutana was so great in terms of he knows how to run the film production, because he can shot 30 shots per day. Yeah, and those seminar scene was shot within two days. Yeah, and I think one of the strange in Yutana's skill is that he came from the theater background. Yeah, so he knows how to run the ensemble of actors. Yeah, because that scene, yeah, there are like 10 or 12 people in the room. Yeah.
It seems to me that the cinematographer must have had quite a lot of experience. It's not just an ordinary camera, it's a photograph. Mm.
I agree, and that's why I think it's really important.
He must have trained as a cinematographer.
Yeah. I think the key to unlocking these questions is the cinematographer, and what no one's gotten in touch with him to talk to him, as far as I'm aware, and I think it's really important. The mark of authorship in the cinematography, the outdoor scene. Mm. Yeah, that makes the film. We need to know about that. Who was behind the camera doing that?
Hi, thank you very much for contextualizing the film. Were there any similar film collectives at the time? And if so, how does Isan relate to them? I mean, what are the similarities? Were there people sending similar messages during this brief moment of Renaissance?
You mean
democracy.
In Thailand or
in
Southeast
yes.
Asia? No. A film collective remains a weird entity in Thai film history. However, I think it might be worth saying
that there were other parallel kinds of grouping which had a closer relationship to the traditional theatre troupe. So although you didn't really have film collectives in Thailand at this point or the point before, you had troupes that made films. So often it took the form of husband and wife team who got together, used the 16mm camera to make narrative fiction film. And actually for a number of decades in Thailand, narrative fiction films were made on silent 16mm stock to be performed live at the moment of screening. You also had troupes who got together in order to travel to show films on small gauge 16mm around the country, so in theatrical and non-theatrical settings. So although the notion, the entity of an artist collective that made film, the Isan Film Collective was a one-off, you had art collectives in modern art context. You also had the troupe who did stuff with the projection equipment and the 16mm camera. So there was that existing tradition of mobile and itinerant filmmaking and film showing.
And were they concerned about similar themes and subjects, for example, social consequences of capitalist development? So there is a broader discussion.
In the first of the Tiny Wave independent filmmaking, there were films that addressed that theme, and particularly the theme of the impact of American neo-imperialism, US neo-imperialism in Thailand, the fate of the prostitute, the consequences of the Vietnam War. Those sorts of films began to be made from the late 1970s and had a moment of renaissance in the early 1980s. But those were made stylistically, they were much closer to films with a sort of new Hollywood-ish influence. So they didn't look and feel like Tom Phan. But thematically, there were similarities.
Was there perhaps any contact or inspiration, contact with or inspiration from similar groups in Japan and India that where there were film collectives engaging with political subjects?
That I'm not sure. I think one way to trace possible contacts would be to think about where people went to study. We know that those sorts of contacts happen between Thailand and the US, because as part of the dynamic of Thailand coming under the sort of being a client state of the US, is that a lot of US money went into the country also in the form of scholarships to, so that people can go out and study and be sort of internalized in US ideology. A lot of people became, you know, whatever, stooges of development because of that, but also a lot of people went to the US to study and were exposed to, you know, the anti-war movement, left ideology, left activism. So you kind of see that sort of trajectory indirectly in the making of Tong Phan. There would have been people who went to Japan and India to study, but that's a story that we know far less about in terms of the sort of possible ramifications in terms of sort of on the art scene and the filmmaking scene coming out of that trajectory.
You sort of said that that Tong Phan was like a ghost film. I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about its initial reception. I mean, how was it screened in Thailand, if it ever was? And, you know, was it shown in a form of collective to have a sort of discussion and debate around the issues that the film offers?
So apparently it was shown once or twice. This is according to the interview with Pai Jong. So she left the country very soon after 1976. The following year, the film was completed, and then she mentioned that it got It was shown once or twice at the Goethe. And then after that, it's not quite that the film was banned in Thailand, but the team didn't submit the film to the censorship board for obvious reasons. At that point, most of them were either in hiding or living in Sweden or outside of the country. And then throughout the 1980s, more broadly in Thailand, there was a period of complete silence about what actually happened in 1976. And that's part of this sort of an air of silence that the narrator talks about at the end of the film. That precisely that was the climate in which we grew up. On the one hand, economic liberalization. Crazy money started coming into Thailand at that point. Crazy traffic jams started happening in Bangkok from the mid-1980s. On the other hand, total silence. What happened in this space? You know, a stone's throw from where I was going to school, that was where people were massacred. Total silence. So it was in this this context that you kind of knew that this film, Thong Phan, existed, but it was never shown. And it wasn't until the late 1990s when it became a little bit more possible to start addressing what happened in 1976 that Thong Phan then came to be shown the first time in back in Thailand again, I believe, was at Thammasat University, the site where the massacre of protesters happened, in a film screening event organized by a political theorist. At that time, he was a student at Thammasat University called Bajak Gongirathit, who since has written the book, the revisionist history about what happened in 1976 and how did it come to be that that's something that barbaric could happen. So he organized a screening, I think for the first time in something like 1996 or 97. And that was the first of a sort of hesitant reappearance of Thong Phan back in Thailand. And as Guy Wood was saying, in terms of its reception, it's up to this point has been contextualized as a kind of NGO issue film. So people who graduated maybe in the 1990s, started working on the NGO scene would probably have come across the film much more readily than people who studied filmmaking and art. Even to this day, you know, talking to artists that we know in Thailand, filmmakers that we know in Thailand, I wouldn't necessarily expect them to have seen Thong Phan. So put it that way, there is a need to have a discussion about Thong Phan in terms of what it does aesthetically, its place in art history and in film history. Do you think there would be, would you foresee problems now to show this?
Not at all.
No, not at all.
And actually one of the fascinating...
There is a time of serious restriction of freedom of speech at the moment in Thailand. Mm. So many things that are discussed here could be, you know, easily linked to situations that are actually happening as we speak. So, but that you think he wouldn't be objected in any way?
No, and maybe partly. One of the sort of fascinating things about Thong Phan's afterlife is if you look at the list of people who were involved with the film, the very different political direction that they subsequently went is, in some cases, politically totally opposite directions. I think showing it now, there wouldn't be a problem at all because it would be seen as a very historical piece of work. Although, of course, as you say, some of the issues raised there are totally contemporary, both in Thailand and also in terms of, you know, regional geopolitics. Dam building.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, China down to what used to be called Indochina. So from that point of view, it remains extremely contemporary. And maybe just to add on that point, in terms of Thong Phan's exhibition afterlife, one of the things that is totally fascinating is one place where you can now see the film on show as the permanent exhibit is actually in the National Gallery of Singapore.
It was also shown in the Thai Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. Yeah, 2015, yeah.
So it's beginning to resurface also in the context of contemporary art. under the sign, in the case of the permanent exhibit at the National Gallery of Singapore, under the sign of Southeast Asia contemporary art. And what's been happening with the opening of the National Gallery of Singapore is that that's the first time and where you have exhibited a collection of work which has been gathered by the curators, gathered and borrowed by the curators of this major institution in Singapore, which calls itself Southeast Asia Modern and Contemporary Art. So the sort of labour that's been going on there is the labour of the creation of this idea of Southeast Asia Modern and Contemporary Art, and Tok Ban is now in a room which is about artworks being produced in Southeast Asia during the decade, 1960s, 1970s, so during the Cold War period. And if I remember correctly, it's probably the only moving image work being shown in that permanent exhibit. So the story of it's coming back in a couple of contexts, like here, as an essay film. I think it's very fascinating. And to bring it back to the essay film, it's very, very interesting, and we're trying to get our head around this, whether it's a very sort of inspired curatorial stroke to situate this as an essay film, but I think it also raises the question, could we use this film in order to discuss what is the limit of the essay film? And I think one of the really interesting things here is that the film features social types, right, and the film reflexively critiques a certain social type. So in terms of its speaking position and the way that it self-critiques the intellectual, the progressive intellectual as a social type, does that dynamic of looking at the author as a collective, where does that sit within the idea of the essay film? Does it work within the context of an essay film?
Could you say something about two things? One, the post-production. You mentioned that it moved to Sweden and the UK, and who was involved in that, and how was it done, and was it difficult? And the other is, what's its position in relation to Thai independent cinema? Was it basically a solo moment, then you have to wait for a decade or so before
it would
be interesting to know both those points.
What do we know about
the post-production?
Yeah.
As I read the interview, I think the film was processed in the lab in Hong Kong. But for the editing, I'm not sure if it happened in I think it is like it happens sometime in Hong Kong and then in London, and then they want to sell the film for the BBC. But Pai Chong said that BBC at that time they didn't has a policy to buy non-British film or something like that. And then they find a buyer in Sweden who bought the film, but bought it at a very low price because the film was unfinished. So, and then then the film was also in the stage of post production in Sweden. So it's like this is there are unclear detail about the post production that what happens when.
Because it actually also got into festivals very quickly. Quite surprised. I thought it would be hidden for a while, but then it was.
I'm not sure if it's screened in 77 or 78, but I found a review written by Tony Raines in the Bulletin Film, the BFI magazine, in March 1979. So it means that it should screen around that time. And my friend asked Tony Wayne that, where did he saw the film, and Tony said that he saw the film at Edinburgh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would make sense. And you found archival documents here. Which name is a distributor of the film? Is Third World
yeah.
Film?
Yeah, Third World Film. Yeah.
And there is a name of a distributor, Conrad.
Yeah.
Something.
I was just interested, and Simon might know better than me, if it was reviewed in Monthly Film Bulletin,
uh-huh.
it should have had a public screening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the distributor, but you said it at
Third World Film.
Yeah,
do
you
know?
I was trying to remember
that?
Who that was.
Yeah, Conrad Taylor, Third World Film. Yeah.
And then the other term, Tony, was the guy doing Third World Cinema.
So the name is Conrad Taylor,
yeah.
somebody. And there's an address as well.
Yeah, there
so
is an address
Oxford.
in Oxford.
But it probably would have had to have a public screening somewhere in London to be reviewed.
To be reviewed in the month.
In the month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I.e. not just in a festival. Yeah.
Okay.
And what about its position in relation to the trajectory of independent cinema in Thailand?
A one-off, like a flash.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it's not been helpful that it's been situated as a film for NGO.
Mm.
Mm.
So that image is somehow stuck. It means it's quite difficult to get people interested in seeing the film. You kind of have to say these days, no, it's not an NGO film, it's more interesting than that, you know.
Do we know whether there were any screenings by academic institutions or trade unions or workers' cultural organisations in European countries, at which perhaps some of the Thai people in exile might have seen it?
In Europe, I don't know. I would guess Sweden, places that has a strong historical link in terms of scholarship to Southeast Asia, so some Scandinavian countries, some. SOAS, I would have thought. SOAS in the 1970s had academics whose research, left-leaning academics who researched Thailand. Australia at the Australian National University. I was recently told by an academic of Southeast Asia studies there that she used to teach the film and she used to show it on 16mm. So it's been getting out by academic network.
I thought the script was really remarkable, and I wondered, because it gives with such it gives such a strong sense of Tong Tan's subjectivity,
mm-hmm.
while being so very brilliantly fragmentary
mm-hmm.
and heterogeneous as a film.
Mm.
And I wondered if that came from Shrinok.
I'm seeing, yes.
And would he have
yeah.
had some written the actual lines?
He said that Pai Jong approached him to write the script, and then because he didn't have time, he gave her the idea. So I think he gave her some kind of a treatment.
Mm.
But the sensibility and the figure of Tong Ban comes straight out of Kam Sing's fiction world. So the mark of authorship there is, I think, to me, very, very strong. And he's still around, just about around. A really fascinating figure. Grew up in the northeast as a farm boy, went to a temple school, so he was one of those sort of farm boy who got educated in temple schools and then became a figure on the art scene. For some of the artists in Thailand during the 20th century, that was kind of the trajectory, and brilliant people came out of that sort of a background. And he went to, when he was an adolescent, he turned up to Bangkok and studied at the, attended the two main universities in Bangkok, Thammasat University and also July University, graduated and got work again as a research assistant to one of the people who the ICA, the CIA sent to Thailand in order to get information about Thailand to help in the sort of Cold War information generation kind of initiative and spying and so on. So Kamsing Sinok worked as a research assistant to a chap called Herbert Phillips for a while, doing work which was quite similar to what Pai Tong Lai Sukun was doing, I think, sort of being the fixer, the contact person between, you know, the white guy and the villagers, and then started writing at that point. So I think that there's a sense that the figures in his story, the peasant figures, are not represented, are not written about from the outside, and I think you get a sense of that with Tong Phan. This was, you know, the sort of mark of authorship of somebody who is no longer part of that world, but knows that world inside out and knows how to figure the sort of unspoken dimension of self-awareness of people from that world and the way that they observe the sort of the bosses, the educated folks, the figures representing the promise of development that come to the village and promise that there'd be electricity development, blah, 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 blah. Quite a lot of his short stories have been translated into English, so they're available to get hold of, and they're really just wonderful, magnificent pieces of satire.
Yeah. And after the student massacre, I think Kamsing fled
to
Sweden. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if he participated in the Sweden phase of the post-production stuff.
Not sure.
Yeah.
Not sure. He was there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And is now lives in a farm in still in the province where Tok Ban was shot, so in the lower part of the northeast of Thailand. Still very honourably, still very left-wing, and this is unusual. There's the perversity of Thai history and politics, which too complicated to go into, means it produces figures such as communists turned royalists, left turned extremely right. So Kamsing Sinok is kind of an anomaly for still being very staunchly left wing.
Sweet spell. I mean, I don't want to bring things brutally to an end, but it seems like maybe it's the moment. Yeah. Well, listen, both of you, that was a fantastic post-screening discussion. It was beautifully, it was so informative and so subtle. I'm really just so grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.